Welcome to Hidden Layers, where we explore the people and technology behind artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Ron Green. I'm thrilled to have Dr. Anna Ivanova joining me today. Anna's research sits at the intersection of language, cognition, and AI, exploring how the brain processes language, how large language models compare to human thought, and how inner speech shapes our thinking. We'll explore some compelling questions. Can large language models really think like humans? What can neuroscience teach us about building smarter AI? And how do models like ChatGPT compare to the human brain when it comes to language and reasoning? Anna is assistant professor of psychology at Georgia Tech and the director of Language, Intelligence, and Thought Lab. Her research explores the relationship between language and cognition, combining cognitive neuroscience and AI modeling. She received her PhD in brain and cognitive sciences from Massachusetts Institute of Technology and was recently named one of MIT Technology Review's innovators under 35. Anna, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I want to jump right in. So you're exploring the language, your thinking, intelligence. You are combining traditional approaches like magnetic resonant imaging with really bleeding edge explorations of artificial intelligence and large language models. And I'm just fascinated by that combination of approaches. In 2024, you published a paper called Disassociating Language and Thought in Large Language Models, and you discussed the capabilities and limitations of language models. Now, granted, that's a field that's moving pretty quickly, but I would love if you could kind of maybe share some of your key findings, and then I want to transition into, you know, some of the practical applications for AI.
Sure. So I am, as you said, a cognitive neuroscientist by training. And so my primary interest is the nature of intelligence and thinking in humans. And now with the rise of AI and large language models in particular, it has turned out that a lot of the questions we're asking about the nature of thinking in humans and the relationship between language and thought are actually very relevant when it comes to trying to understand artificial intelligence, not just biological intelligence. And then not only are the questions similar, the approaches and the tools that we can use to try and answer them also are somewhat similar, except that in the case of AI, you actually have much more leverage, right? You have for open models, full access to the system. You can take it apart. You can see what it does. You can try controlled rearing where you train it on a specific diet. And so in some way, the questions are similar. The tools are similar, except that you can do much more. So it's very exciting. And so for me, I just have all kinds of scientific questions that I'm interested in when looking at these artificial systems and trying to figure out what they do. And in the paper that you mentioned, Dissociating Language and Thought in Large Language Models, we try to apply some of the insights we have about humans and the human brain to how we might approach these artificial systems and what we might even want from them and what kinds of capabilities we might even want to try and evaluate. And it's interesting because we started writing this paper with my co-authors, I think in 2020. I think it was the pandemic. It was actually like the idea was there, I think, right before GPT-3 came out. So really back in the day. And every time a new model would come out, we would ask ourselves, oh, you know, is our paper still relevant, right? Has everything changed now? And it's actually been very interesting to see how much of our framing has held up even in the face of this rapid development of AI capabilities. So what we say there is fairly straightforward, that even though these things are called language models, the reason why everybody cares about them is not as models of language, but primarily as models of intelligence. We don't care necessarily about them producing grammatical texts, but we care about, can they reason? What do they know? Can they answer our queries in a socially intelligent way? And so we're saying, well, look, these are different things. So you kind of need both linguistic ability. So we call that formal linguistic competence, knowing a specific language, the rules and patterns of the grammar, the vocabulary. Without it, you're not going to get coherent input out, and you're not going to be able to parse, get the meaning out of the input that the model receives. So you need linguistic skills. But you also need all the stuff that goes on top in order to effectively make use of the linguistic information that you receive as a model. And so we call that functional linguistic competence, all of the reasoning skills, world knowledge, social competencies. And so we say, well, look, in the brain, in the human brain, these are supported by different systems. We have the language brain network, which is responsible for extracting meaning from language and converting thoughts into language. And then we have other systems dedicated to reasoning, to specialized knowledge, to social ability. And so when we're trying to figure out what these systems can and cannot do, we should evaluate each of these capabilities in their own right.
Right. And one of the things that I think is really interesting that I wouldn't have expected, you know, 5 years ago, was that we would have AI systems with enough capabilities at this point that we could actually try to understand how they work as a way to understanding how our own brains and thoughts and consciousness and thinking works. But there's also obviously a danger because, you know, our own brains are just an artifact of, you know, some evolutionary path, right? Just the way you can have, you know, planes fly like jets, not fly the same way birds do, it's not necessarily the case that the way we think has to be mimicked by AI, right? There might be other ways to go about this. And so one of the things I really wanted to understand is, to what extent do we understand at a deep level the differences between the way current large language models work and the way our own internal dialogue goes? Because I've read your work, and you talk about, maybe we can dive in a little bit about how some people believe they think in words, and some people think maybe, you know, without words, and they're thinking maybe more conceptually. I would love to kind of dig into this whole area.
Yeah, so you've brought up several different topics, so let's see what's the good one to start with. So I guess maybe let's pick up on this observation that you put forth, that now we can actually use these models to gain additional insight into how humans might be doing certain cognitive tasks. And yeah, indeed, that's a very exciting, novel time. So this line of work, I refer to it as years two. We refer to it as using AI systems as model organisms. We have the system, it's doing a certain behavior. We can try to figure out how it succeeds at this behavior. And then, as we do for model organisms in, say, biology, we study, say, the kidneys in mice, hoping that the drugs we develop to treat kidney disease will transfer over to humans. So a model might or might not actually reflect what's going on in our main system of interest in humans. Similarly, for LLMs, they might or might not be solving the task in the same way. So we can never take that for granted. But it's definitely useful, at least as a source of inspiration and hypothesis about what might be possible. And so one thing we found is LLMs have helped advance the dialogue in linguistics quite a bit, because in linguistics, there was this big debate about whether or not it's even possible to learn grammar from observing grammatical inputs in language, right? So can children figure out grammar from just hearing the language and then figuring out the rules? Or do they already need to have the rules built into their minds and then just kind of adjust it depending on which language they're exposed to? And so LLMs tell us, well, look, it's possible to learn everything from the input. Of course, LLMs use many orders of magnitudes more data than a human would. So humans might have some inductive biases to help them find the right rules more quickly, but at least in principle, it's possible. And so it's a really cool existence proof that there is enough signal in the data to figure it out. And in fact, these kinds of pattern recognition abilities that these models have works better than any kind of symbolic NLP system that people have been trying to build for decades, because language is fuzzy and lots of it is patterns and not general rules. And so that's the case where engineering and science actually both benefit from these examples.
Right. Okay. You touched on something that I was really excited to discuss later, but let's just dive into it now. The history of linguistics is really, really rich. And there have been some pretty hard positions taken in the past that I personally feel that advances in AI have kind of shown to be maybe misguided. Somebody no less renowned than, like, say, Noam Chomsky has said some pretty harsh things. So, yeah, I've got a quote here. It says, Noam said, large language models are just, quote, lumbering statistical engines for pattern matching. And then Scott Aronson, who I'm a pretty big fan of, he was on the podcast last year. He's framed the capabilities of large language models in a way that I actually really firmly agree with. He has said that the emergent ability of large language models, just through this, you know, next token prediction learning regime, is, in his opinion, the most important scientific discovery of the 21st century. And he responds to Chomsky with this quote. He says, Chomsky and his followers are ultimately angry at reality itself for having the timidity to offer something up that they didn't predict and that doesn't fit the worldview. And I would love to get your thoughts on this sort of linguistic debate, and has the has your research changed your opinion on that much?
Yeah, so Chomsky and linguistics for decades, right, as long as Chomsky has been doing it, has been against the statistical pattern approach to language. The idea being, well, look, you might have sentences that are very rare that have never been said before, and it doesn't change the fact that they are grammatical if they are. Or you can have a bunch of words, each word is very common, and altogether the sentence that they make up is still not grammatical. Right?
The famous example is like fuzzy green thoughts, sleeping furiously.
Colorless green ideas, yeah. Sleep furiously. Yeah. There you go. Exactly. And so a lot of these arguments were based on early era statistical language models, like the n-gram models, which were tracking probabilities of specific words in a short window of 3, 4, 5 words. And LLMs are showing us how much more there is to pattern matching, that now these models can abstract more subtle patterns, they can abstract nonlinear patterns, generalize across specific words, and extrapolate rules to similar words, which the n-gram models couldn't do. And so, yeah, I think they're just opening up our horizons about what is even possible from statistical pattern learning when it comes to extracting either linguistic information or information related to world knowledge and reasoning. Mm-hmm. And one point we make in the paper is that not next word prediction, right? So this basic objective function enables pattern learning that gives you formal linguistic competence. It seems fairly easily, fairly early on. So GPT-2 already has most of what you need to get grammatical sentences out. GPT-3 and onward, these models produce grammatical, coherent, fluent language. But when it comes to functional competence, when it comes to general world knowledge, when it comes to reasoning, that's where it seems next word prediction is no longer enough, or at least it's not as efficient, right? We're getting into the long tail of predictions where you have a lot of data about grammar, because every single text in English will have some information that the model can leverage to learn grammatical rules. But when it comes to specific factual knowledge, reasoning tasks, just kind of blindly sourcing data from the internet is not necessarily the most efficient way of providing with information to the model. And as a result, for the last 2 years, a lot of effort has gone into fine-tuning these models and giving them specific tasks and fine-tuning them with human feedback or without to do better at the specific tasks, where just next word prediction on like anything doesn't seem to be as effective anymore. So it's actually a way to move away from just scaling up to more targeted training, fine-tuning. And then in the kind of extreme end of it is saying, well, look, these models aren't going to get us all the way there. And so then these models are augmented with other modules for reasoning, for code program execution, for factual knowledge retrieval, like RAG systems. So we see that pattern learning does not get us all the way, that you do need something more.
Right, right. And I think if we were having this conversation last summer, before the advent of some of these reasoning models, I would have been probably deeply more skeptical than I am now about how far we could push this sort of autoregressive regime. I'd love to get your thoughts on the changes that we've seen. So let's talk about reasoning models. A year ago, language models, very impressive grammatical capabilities, could make really incredibly silly mistakes, right? You know, very, very famously, you could ask it how many R's are in the word strawberry, and you'd get, you know, just random different examples. It really just felt like, regardless of how incredibly perceptive their output could sometimes be, there wasn't really anybody home, right? There wasn't really an underlying reasoning capability within these models. We've now had OpenAI's release of O1 and O3, and I think those are really interesting, but I'm personally really fascinated by DeepSeek's R1. And the reason is it appears, and we're seeing third-party replications of this, that the reasoning capability that R1 has sort of emerged. It was trained on cold start data with chain of thought reasoning, but that did not have any of this sort of introspective, what they call aha moments, where it would say like, wait, let me go back. I think I've made a contradiction. Let me go analyze my output. I just love your opinion on this. Are you surprised by this emergent reasoning behavior? Do you think it is emergent? Do you think it tells us anything about human intelligence? Is it going to factor into your research going forward?
Yeah. One reason I'm really excited about the DeepSeek conversation is because finally we have an open model where we have a lot of information about what actually is going on, and people have replicated the fine-tuning process as well. And that stands in stark contrast with GPT-4, GPT-401, all of the other ones where we could only kind of guess at what's going on, what's being used, what the architecture is, right? Even the very basic things,
exactly,
we didn't really know. And so it was very hard to kind of say anything concrete about these models. And I guess at OpenAI, they kind of confirmed that a lot of the approaches that you are using are the same as what DeepSeek is doing. So as a scientist, I'm very excited to have an open system where we can actually start to make headway in understanding what it's doing, how it's doing. I have not looked at the literature in enough detail. And I mean, the literature, the model is what, like R1 is 2-3 weeks old at this point, a month, right.
Right.
And so the aha moment examples, I'm not yet fully sure if they are like handpicked examples or if that's a systematic behavior that has indeed emerged. Clearly, overall, it does well in reasoning tasks. And so that's an impressive capability that absolutely needs to be examined. But yeah, so chain of thought, I guess, is a way for us to get back to the inner speech question that you asked earlier and I didn't answer. And the reason why is because that's actually an area of research which is just emerging in my lab. We're in early stages of launching an inner speech research program in humans. As you mentioned, we find, or other people find, that humans vary a lot in how much they use language during their internal thinking process. So some people apparently do seem to have a chain of thought going on in their mind as they're solving a problem. They're talking to oneself, figuring out what's happening, what's going on, and converting that into linguistic form that they feed then back to their own mind without verbalizing it. Some people have it in the form of a monologue. Some people have it in the form of a dialogue. But that speech doesn't necessarily have to be fully language-like. Oftentimes, people report having condensed inner speech, which means it's not fully grammatical sentences, but rather just certain phrases and certain patterns that you might verbalize to get from one thought to the next. But it doesn't have to be the full unfolded sequence of words like you have when you're actually producing speech. And then some people seem to not have the experience of internal language whatsoever. So it's a minority of the population. We don't know how many people have that exactly, but I would say probably, let's put it at around 5%. And so there is now a term that has been coined for it recently, anendophasia. It's mirroring a finding from about a decade ago of aphantasia. So aphantasia are people who don't seem to have mental imagery, that they don't have visual pictures in their mind. And so similar to that, anendophasia is people who don't seem to be using inner speech, their inner voice when thinking. Mm-hmm. And so if these people say speak multiple languages, they say, I don't know, speak English and Mandarin, you can ask them, what language do you usually think in? And they will just look at you. I've had this experience with a couple of people. They're like, I just think, like, what do you mean? Which language? I use a language when I speak, not when I think. And so there is just this huge gradient that goes unacknowledged in a lot of these chain of thought models, right? They kind of assume that language is the medium of thought, even though in humans, it seems like it doesn't have to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of my co-founders speaks English and Mandarin. I asked him this once, and he said that he kind of thinks in whatever language he's speaking, right? He is, I think that is part of maybe being really, really fluent. I don't know, maybe that varies, but
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But so this kind of amazes me, because when I read about this, I had no idea that there might be different sort of cognitive processes that we go through. I definitely feel like I am almost like an autoregressive model. I know very often what I want to communicate, but I don't know what words I'm going to use in the exact order as I begin communicating. And in fact, like as I'm speaking right now, I'm not exactly sure what every word would be in the sentence. Is that insight, like, you know, as a non-expert in this field, is the fact that these autoregressive models operate in that way, outputting tokens before they have any idea? Like, let me be concrete here. There are some examples where they'll say, you know, answer this question, but before you answer it, tell me how many words you're going to use, right? And so it has to tell you the number of words that we use first, and then it spits out the rest of it. And very famously, it usually doesn't get that right. You know, it makes up some number or some reasonable number. Has this impacted our understanding of the human brain and our thought process, or is it just still too early?
I think we knew already that speech production happens in this not fully conscious way where we have a thought, but we are constructing what we're about to say on the fly. There is definitely some planning going on. An example that I teach in class is speech errors, where you say something and then maybe you swap two words in a sentence, right? You swap two sentences in a word, right? Like you, right. These things kind of happen that suggest that you've already pre-activated both of these words and you were planning to get them out, but you accidentally switched the order. So it does show you that some planning is happening, but it's incomplete and you can make errors and a lot of it is not conscious. It's an interesting question how much of that happens inside LLMs as well, and how similar that process is. I think it's fascinating. It's also fascinating to figure out how much advanced planning is going on, how much an embedding for a current token can predict about which tokens are going to be produced 1 or 2 sentences down the road. I think there is a lot of open questions there that can be studied. We're just, you know, not there yet. And it's very exciting. One project that I haven't been able to find a student to lead, maybe it's going to happen. I don't know, maybe somebody's listening, is for earlier models, like GPT-4 or whatever, the fact that they can generate poetry means that they know something about rhymes, means that when they generate the first word in a line, they know that it has to end in a word that rhymes with the line before. But that whole thing has to be grammatical, right? So they cannot just like get to that word at the end and be like, oh yeah, now I have to do a rhyme.
Right.
Right. So they must have planned at least that whole line to be grammatical and to end in a particular word that rhymes. So can we decode that from the very beginning of that line? How does this information work? How does it get used? We don't know. But I think these are the kind of questions that are fascinating and we can study reasonably easily in LLMs, and maybe it is going to tell us something about humans.
Within biology, there has been this real strong move towards sort of computational biology, this idea of leveraging AI to do things like protein folding, et cetera. Within sort of, you know, cognitive neuroscience, is there pushback? Do you get pushback in your work around, you know, looking at AI and AI systems to better understand the human cognitive process? Or is that becoming kind of like biology, it's becoming accepted now?
It's becoming accepted now. I think people started using these systems more and more maybe a decade ago. So vision was the first where the deep learning revolution happened, right? And so the AlexNet breakthrough on ImageNet and vision on object recognition was about 2012. By 2014, people have started to use deep vision models to predict brain responses to images, to map linearly between different layers of an artificial net and different regions of the brain to show the parallels in the representational properties of both systems. And so these were the pioneers who encountered the most pushback. And now, 10 years later, we can be like, well, look, people are doing it in vision. It kind of works in vision. So let's see if it works in language as well. Right. So that's one line of work that's gaining traction, is directly mapping between an artificial neural network and the brain to see how similar or different the representations are. And this enables us to predict brain responses to lots of new words and new sentences that we haven't had brain data for before, which accelerates scientific discovery. So we can do those in silico experiments in the cloud, predict what a brain response might look like, and then only test it for a subset of stimuli instead of getting expensive brain data for every single one. So that's one line of work. And then another line of work is the model organism stuff we mentioned, where we can go and figure out how these systems behave, what they do. And then, of course, the caveat there is that we can never be sure that humans do it in the same way, and we shouldn't assume. And so some of these might not generalize, and I think that's okay and still fun and worthwhile just figuring out on its own.
Do you think in our lifetimes we will be able to understand at a real deep level how human consciousness, how our thought process thinking occurs, meaning I imagine in my mind, you know, you almost have a microscope with just incredible resolution, and we could go down to the finest level of detail, and just the way we can sort of dissect really large language models is challenging because they're so large, right? And they're so computationally intensive. But imagine if we had enough compute and we had enough resolving ability. Do you think that we're like maybe 50 years away from understanding at a real deep level consciousness and what it means when humans are thinking?
I'm optimistic. I see how quickly the field is developing, both neuroscience and AI. And of course, they are helping each other, reinforcing each other. And 50 years, I mean, look, like things are changing every year now. And of course, eventually we're going to start running into some roadblocks and slow down, unless, you know, singularity gets us all.
Right.
But I think there is so much more that we're learning. There will be things that we'll need to revisit and make sure that they're robust and they're replicable and hold, right? So this kind of explosive pace will need to slow down to make sure that our science is robust, that we're, you know, a little bit more like physics, where predictions have been verified independently by hundreds and thousands of people. But yeah, and an interesting thing about looking at these deep neural network systems, we know that just being able to record activations from all parts of the system doesn't necessarily give us understanding.
Right.
Right. These systems are not, I mean, for an open model, it's not a black box, it's a white box. You can look at all the weights and all the activations, but then you need to be able to develop meaningful abstractions to make sense of the activations by themselves. So they're not going to be meaningful on their own. You need to figure out ways to see how they give rise to specific representations, how the learning dynamics or the representational dynamics affects behavior. So going from this mess of activations and weights and predictions to behavior, linking the internals and the function, that's the hard problem in both neuroscience and AI. But I also think it's a really exciting one. So some people feel very daunted by it, but to me, that's a cool, fun challenge to figure out.
Okay, I think that's a perfect note to end on. So, Anna, thank you so much. This was a really, really fun conversation, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thanks, and thanks for your questions.
Thank you for listening to Hidden Layers. This series is hosted by Kung Fu AI, a management consulting and engineering firm focused exclusively on artificial intelligence. If you have any questions or thoughts about today's episode, or if you know someone we should feature, please visit us at kungfu.ai.